I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. Colleagues, we're going to start out by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3013. And Bob, can you give us a brief summary of the bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3013 excludes certain appraisals from public records disclosure exemption covering records submitted to a housing authority or urban renewal agency by applicants for loans, grants, and tax credits.
Great. And we have Representative Esquivel to speak to us on this bill. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. Let me give you a little story about how this transpired and how we got here today. We have in our community, which Representative Richardson would probably remember, we have a situation of where the Housing Authority of Jackson County purchased a piece of property and then changed the zoning and put high-density housing, or trying to put high-density housing, into a residential area. Which is fine, because that's the way that process works. But they did ask for the appraisal to take a look at it, to see how much it appraised out for and how much it was paid for. They were refused by the Housing Authority because there was a loophole in the law that allowed them not to have to divulge that, even though it was done with taxpayer money. And that's where I came involved in it, because if it's taxpayer money and the transaction's closed, it doesn't matter at that point. It's public record. It should be public record. And the appraisal itself should be public record because it's paid for by public dollars. And you may hear someone may say, well, yeah, but they could use that appraisal for something else. Well, not really, because you have to have a different one for a different property. You cannot use the same appraisal on a like property without having the same address, because every property is different. But what I didn't care for was the fact that if it's public, shouldn't we have transparency in this? That's our job, is to be transparent. And this made us, as elected officials and part of the government, it made us look pretty shabby, and there wasn't anything we could do about it. So that's why we're here, and we've just changed a couple sentences, you can see, in the whole bill, which I thought, oh my God, what have I done when I first looked at it, but then I see there's only a couple of pages that we changed that. So that's what it's about. It's about transparency with public monies after a closure of an escrow. I'm available for any questions.
Questions from the committee?
Good. Bill should pass.
Representative Doherty.
Representative Esquivel, I mean, what was the purpose of the appraisal and the reason for the appraisal and to not have it public?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, the Housing Authority had purchased a piece of property in this neighborhood mm-hmm. from a developer, but wouldn't divulge how much it appraised for. We knew how much that it sold for. And these people couldn't tell whether they were the same or more or less. So therefore, they wanted to know whether we overpaid for that property, which I thought, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder. And I always look at it like, what is a piece of property worth? It's worth as much as someone wants to pay for it.
Correct.
But on the other hand, if it appraises out, and I believe they paid over $1 million for this 5 acres, and that seems a little high, but you never know because you didn't see the appraisal.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions?
Can we work it?
Not under a public hearing. I appreciate you bringing it forward. It doesn't appear that we have anybody signed up opposing this bill, and I don't know if the agency's in the room or not.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I did ask the attorney for what represents Jackson County Housing Authority work with me on the bill. And when I sent a message for him to contact me quite some time ago before we got back into session, I never received a response. So I would have gladly worked with it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for taking
the
time
Chair.
And bringing us a transparency bill, evidently. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3013. Bob, did we have any other representatives here to speak at the moment? Don't see any. So with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3070. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 3070, please.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3070 requires a person advertising consumer goods for sale to clearly disclose shipping and handling charges for transactions. It includes goods purchased from a retail establishment and taken into purchaser's possession immediately and makes violation of these new provisions an unlawful trade practice.
Okay.
Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, I will. For the record, I'm Representative Margaret Doherty. I represent House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. You know, folks, we've all seen the infomercials on television featuring the very enthusiastic actors with a variety of products and things that we simply are going to change our lives. And a while ago, I saw an infomercial on a product that I knew was going to change my life. It was something called the Samurai Shark. And the shark is a small kitchen gadget that you can use to sharpen knives. And not only did I get one shark for $9.95, but I was so lucky I got two sharks for the price of one. So I was very enthusiastic, and since I'm cheap, I figured I didn't want to go through and have to pay to get my knife sharpened. So I bought the Samurai Shark. And went online, or was online, but I called and gave them my credit card and all this kind of thing. And they advertised it for it, but however, when I received the sharks in the mail, I discovered that they had charged me an extra $15.20 for postage and handling. And nowhere in the television advertisement it said plus postage and handling did it ever go through and say exactly what that postage and handling was going to do. And so, you know, if I had been informed of what the postage and handling was, possibly I wouldn't have done this. And I know this will surprise some of you, but I actually took my sharks to the post office and found out how expensive it would be to mail both of them in a box. It was about $1.95. So the bottom line for all of this is that the product is fairly inexpensive, although the Samurai Shark works very well. It's a very good product.
changed your life.
But the money was made on the handling. And I noticed just a couple of weeks ago, before he filed this, is that on television, sometimes the advertisement said $9.95 plus shipping and handling. In the parentheses, they say $13.20. Half of them had them and half of them didn't. And so what 3070 would require is clear disclosure of all shipping and handling fees that are associated with buying a product. And colleagues, I have a small floral design business, and that's one of the things I disclose. I say the floral arrangement will be X, and if you want it delivered, it will be, you know, X amount of dollars more. And so I'm aware of costs that are associated with doing business and shipping and delivery and so on. I think that many of you have seen these infomercials and see that they really don't disclose it. So that's what the bill does, is go through and disclose what the shipping and handling would be. We looked at some other states, and there are about 13 states that have shipping and handling requirements. Sometimes it's on free prizes. Sometimes it's not necessarily dealing with specifically with what I have, but it does disclose what the handling charges will be. There is an amendment, which you have, that clarifies some of the language in the bill, specifically emphasizing that what we are looking at is disclosure of the cost associated with shipping and handling before the actual sale. We're working to have, we have the amendment drafted, and what this does is it echoes language that says that, for example, if you go to an AT&T store or a Verizon store or something and buy a cell phone, or you see the advertisements in the newspaper saying if you go to your Verizon store, you can get whatever. Those are not the shipping and handling kind of charges that we're talking about, because those are ones that when you go in and buy the phone, when you go into an actual retail establishment, either you're not shipping or if you're shipping, you know exactly what it is. It's not those ones that you go online and see things, because immediately when you buy something online, it shows what the shipping and handling is going to be, and then you have a choice choose whether to buy that product or not. And so, as I say, you have the amendment, and it talks about that it is at the point of sale for shipping and handling that they must be disclosed. So I think it's very important for the consumer to be able to at least know what they're purchasing and know that the shipping and handling charges are not the actual price of what the product is. So it would really it would establish no limits on what shipping and handling would be for the business. It would just require that they disclose to the consumer before the consumer buys a product, and so I see no downside for an informed customer to make that choice as to whether they want to buy or not. So I'm open for questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, much of the media that we see or exposed to doesn't originate in Oregon.
Pardon?
Much of the media that we are exposed to, i.e. cable type stuff and so forth, doesn't originate in our state. These are advertisements that are
That I don't know. That I don't know. What I am, it was kind of unusual that how come, like, especially, and I'm talking pretty much the television advertisements that you see, that half of them have shipping and handling disclosed and half of them don't. And so I have a feeling that it is purchased here in Oregon, whether it is generated and created in Oregon, the advertisements is something else. I doubt that the advertisements are created here in Oregon.
Correct. Follow up. Are you advocating then for the exact amount of the shipping and handling to be clearly displayed in that commercial, or is it just enough to say additional shipping and handling required if you get your second shark?
Did not specifically ask, and it is just that the shipping and handling needs to be disclosed at the point of sale. And so with me, it was the idea, since when I went through this purchase, it was not disclosed at the time because it was not required of them, that what I'm kind of looking for is that it be disclosed the exact amount on television, on that advertisement. Because they say most of it seemed to be about the same price. It was only like $13.20, but it would be disclosed on the advertisement, I think would be the easiest way to do it. But again, the bill does not specifically address that. It's just that at the point of sale, they must disclose all of the shipping and handling to the purchaser before the sale is completed.
Representative Thatcher?
I guess I'm a little unclear on whether you're indicating you want to be on the television the exact amount or just disclosed at the time of sale.
Well, what I want is I want it advertised on television.
Oh.
But what the bill reads is at the disclosure, at the point of sale, before the sale is concluded.
Okay, and follow up too.
Follow.
All right. Well, I just also had a question about, it seems like sometimes when I'm buying something online, I'll notice that the shipping and handling can vary,
mm-hmm.
you know, depending on how quickly you want it, one, and where you are located.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe we're in Hawaii, maybe we're in Uganda. I mean, it would vary a lot. So it seems like it would be difficult to say, this is going to be this much without maybe perhaps really overcharging.
Yeah. That's what I thought of until I looked at it. And basically, it was products like the Samurai Shark and these kind of things that whether I was mailing this to Portland, Oregon, or Portland, Maine, and it did come through U.S. Postal Service, the amount was the same amount of money. What differed was the largest amount was the handling cost. And so the shipping was shipping whether you're going from one end of the country to the other on products like this. I mean, if you're buying something that is an oven or something like that, might be different. But what I was referring to was things like that. But it, again, making sure that it is disclosed before the sale is finished. And so people know exactly what they're paying for shipping and handling. Because when the handling is more than what the cost of the product is, that's where they're making their money.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Now you're going back to the point of sale, which makes more sense to me. But you're also talking about putting it on the ad. So I guess
I was using it as an example that it is unusual that half of it you can see, half of the advertisements you have it, half of the advertisements you don't. A lot of times that is the easiest way to go through and say when the shipping and handling is. But if you call up, you know, the 1-800 number, they are not compelled to tell you what the shipping and handling costs are, you know, if I call from Oregon for that. And so what they would have to do would, before they would take a credit card number or anything like that, they would have to say, it is $9.95, the shipping and handling is $13.20 for a total of whatever. Now would you like to continue with the transaction?
Okay, so that's what this bill is.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
Yeah. And so it gives them leeway as to whether it's on television, whether it's some, whether it's online, whether it's vocally, you know. So.
Other questions?
Okay.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to figure out if my Von Trapp Sound of Music commemorative plate is going to go up or down in value. I support that.
I would not be able to make that. And the one thing I will, we did have some of the folks working on the amendment to make sure that it did not have unintended consequences for retail stores that are already established that might ship for you.
Thank you very much for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening.
Up next, I have Elise Brown and Angela Martin, please.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, Angela Martin with Economic Fairness Oregon. I want to thank Representative Doherty for the thorough explanation. I'm here testifying in support of House Bill 3070 with the -1 amendment to clarify that the disclosure needs to be made at the point of purchase. Not too much to add. We've heard that this is really one of those nuisance issues where a product is advertised as almost too good to be true, either because it's going to make your life easier or it's such a fire sale. And then when you receive the good, you realize that your shipping and handling costs could exceed the cost of the good, sometimes by 2 or 3 times. A consumer is not willing to go to bat and fight for months and months to get a $19.95 shipping and handling charge reversed, and the money ends up going directly into the pocket of the recipient. This simply puts sunshine on the shipping and handling costs, and so again, say that we support it with the -1 amendment. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown here for AT&T. It is AT&T actually worked with Rep. Doherty on the -1 amendment. So those were a concern of AT&T, and the reason we brought them forward is for a lot of the same reasons that have been shared just learning about the bill this afternoon. Our first read is that this bill would mandate that you disclose shipping and handling in all advertising channels. And for us, that was a problem. And I think the biggest issue with it is that it's confusing to consumers, particularly those that are reading the paper every day. And in our case, maybe looking at a cell phone or other wireless-related device, and knowing that paper medium is really used to drive folks to retail outlets to disclose shipping and handling in your advertising is confusing at best. So it was our desire to create this language that would make it crystal clear that the issue really is disclosure at the time of the sales transaction. And we think the -1s get us there. So we can support this bill with the adoption of the -1 amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony. With that, I'll close public hearing on House Bill 3070. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2600. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 2600, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2600 requires the name of an individual debtor on a financing statement to match the name of debtor on debtor's Oregon driver license or identification card. It becomes operative on July 1, 2013 and declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. So up first, let's have Tim Martinez, Steve Philpott, and Steve Turgeson.
Good morning, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Bankers of Oregon. To my immediate right is Stephen Philpott, who is the Executive Vice President and General Counsel of Umpqua Holdings Corporation, as well as Umpqua Bank. He's here to provide some of the legal background. And then to his right is Steve Turgeson, who's from Citizens Bank out of Corvallis, and he is also an executive vice president and the chief lending officer, and he's here to provide some examples and answer questions on the lending side of this issue. First of all, Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing us to have this bill heard today. We certainly appreciate that. I'd like to give a little bit of background before I turn it over to the experts. I'll try to be brief. This bill deals with the Uniform Commercial Code and Article 9 as the Uniform Commercial Code, and for folks that are new to the committee. The Uniform Commercial Code is a uniform law that comes to you from the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws and the American Law Institute. This particular article deals primarily with financing and lending issues. It is updated approximately 10 to 15 years. In fact, I just threw out the last update materials from, I believe it was 1993 perhaps, or 95. And what the Uniform Law Commissioners did in this case was they gave states an opportunity to choose between two options when identifying a borrower. Option A, which is primarily the use of a driver's license, and I would suggest to you, if you've bought anything recently, a car, a house, or any other major purchase, the first thing the seller probably asked for was your driver's license. I know ODOT doesn't always like that to be used as a form of identification, but it's really the closest thing we have, that and a Social Security card, as far as identifying ourselves. So that's option A. Option B is fairly similar to what we have now. It includes a driver's license. It also includes other pieces of ID. And as you'll hear from my bankers here on the right, that potentially is going to cause a lot of problems. We're back here today because in 2012, the legislature at that time went with option B, which was and still continues to be the recommendation of the Oregon Law Commission. And these uniform laws do run through the Oregon Law Commission for their review. We did have a member on the group that looked at that. He advocated for A. The commission went with B, and I'll let them explain after, you know, the group behind me why they preferred B. I would simply make two points. One is that this particular filing, 90% or more are done by lenders, and we believe that A is the best. But even if you have some doubts about A, I would point out to you that the uniform law folks said A or B is acceptable. Okay, so if you believe that that is the case and you could go either way, I would just point out that as of today, 29 states have adopted A. 6 states have adopted B. So clearly the overwhelming majority have gone with A. And I will tell you that 2 of the 6 that have adopted B are Washington and Oregon. Washington is in the process, and they will, before the end of their session, both bodies have passed the bill, will switch to A. So they will now be 30. Every state around Oregon, whether it's Washington, whether it's Idaho, Utah, Nevada, have all or will all be A. California, obviously, is always the elephant in the room. They're having a hearing today, and it's my understanding, in talking to my colleagues to the south, that A will be the preferred option there as well. So our guess is by the time you get to July 1, which is the operating date, so we're not out of, you know, there's no issues at this point because it doesn't go into effect until July 1. We expect when we get to July 1, over 40 states will have gone with option A. And the closest state to us that will be a B state will be Colorado. Again, we think, you know, the uniform commercial code ought to be as uniform as we can make it. I think the costs go up, not just for searches, but for surrounding states. If everybody around us is A and they're looking at collateral in the state of Oregon and how they're going to have to search for that. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Philpott to expand on some of the points I've made.
Thank you, Tim, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak this afternoon. As Tim mentioned, I'm Executive Vice President, General Counsel, and Corporate Secretary for Umpqua Bank. Umpqua is a regional community bank. We have operations in four states, about 200 branches, and I live and work in Eugene. And Umpqua is headquartered in the state of Oregon as well. I speak today in strong support of House Bill 2600.
Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
I'm sorry?
Could you state your name for the record, please?
Yeah, Steve Philpott, Philpott. And this House Bill 2600 will bring Oregon in line with the vast majority of states that have looked at this uniform law. And I think a primary consideration is that there's no merit, there's no advantage to being the odd man out in connection with the Uniform Commercial Code. The whole purpose of the Uniform Commercial Code is to promote uniformity across the country in the way that, in this particular case, loans are documented and perfected. So what is the way we support it? It's simple. It facilitates consumer and small business lending. The use of the driver's license is in sync with consumer behavior. Everybody carries a driver's license with them. It avoids or at least minimizes conflict and litigation over priorities, and it makes the Uniform Commercial Code more uniform. What does 2600 say? It says simply that if an individual has a state-issued driver's license or identification card, then it is that version of the individual's name that goes on the financing statement. And this is what we're talking about, a UCC financing statement. And we're talking about what information goes in these four highlighted boxes: last name, first name, middle name, and suffix, if any. And this form is standard throughout the country. It perfects a lender's security interest in things like untitled boats and trailers and tools and equipment, any kind of personal property like that where you have an individual debtor. And why does it matter? Well, it matters because lenders want to know that they are in a first lien position on the collateral that they think they have as security for the loan. If a prior lender can perfect its security interest under any one of several versions of an individual's name, then another lender has to search under each of those possible versions to see if somebody else has a prior lien on that same collateral. So what goes in the boxes now? Let's say you're Billy Bob Thornton. What goes in the boxes now? Is it Billy Bob Thornton? Is it William R. Thornton? Is it William Robert Thornton, W. Robert Thornton? It could be any of those. And under those circumstances, the lender is going to have to search under any of those possible variations of the name. And this anything-goes approach, frankly, leads to priority conflicts among lenders and between bankruptcy trustees and lenders. So what is the reason that's given to support the current law, which is Alternative B? According to the work group's report to the Oregon Law Commission, it is to protect attorneys from malpractice claims and to protect unsophisticated consumer lenders. I would submit that not very much consumer lending in this state or any other state is done by unsophisticated lenders. Most of it's done by community banks like ours, by credit unions, and by institutional lenders who know the rules and follow the rules. And I would also argue that protecting attorneys from malpractice claims is not even a minor goal of the Uniform Commercial Code. We protect the public from legal malpractice claims by having strict licensing standards, by mandatory continuing legal education, and by mandatory malpractice insurance. We shouldn't do it by letting attorneys off the hook for knowing the law or not knowing the law, or make the law so loosey-goosey that any name will work on a financing statement. So let's say that Billy Bob Thornton has a small excavating company, and he goes, and he's a sole proprietor, and he goes to his local credit union for a working capital loan, and he wants to pledge his equipment. His name on his birth certificate is William Robert Thornton. His name on his driver's license is Billy R. Thornton. His name on his Social Security card is William R. Thornton. And everybody knows him as Billy Bob. Under current law, the credit union has to search under each of those possibilities, and probably others too. But Billy Bob will have his driver's license with him. He probably won't have his birth certificate with him when he goes into the credit union. He may or may not have a Social Security card. But in 99 times out of 100, Billy Bob's going to have his driver's license with him. And so the credit union simply takes a photocopy of his driver's license. Under alternative A, House Bill 2600, the credit union would do a search under that driver's license name. That's the only search that they would have to do once the law is fully in effect. And that's how they would document that loan. If I can just take 1 minute, let me give you a real-life example out of the Central District of Illinois. This is a case that was reported in the UCC Reporter Service. It's Miller versus State Bank of Arthur. Benny A. Miller and Debbie A. Miller borrowed money from the Bank of Arthur to purchase a lawn equipment business. Mr. Miller was identified on all of the loan documents as Benny A. Miller. He testified that he had gone by the name Benny Miller for most of his adult life. And that was his name on the driver's license and a Social Security card, Benny A. Miller. But Ben Miller is the name listed on his birth certificate. The loan goes through, and years later, Mr. and Mrs. Miller filed a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. And then they initiated an adversary proceeding against the bank to avoid the bank's security interest in their business assets. The bankruptcy court ruled in favor of the Millers, finding that Illinois law required the bank to use the debtor's, quote, correct name. And I would submit that that's a nebulous term, much like what we find in Oregon's current law, which is to use the debtor's, quote, individual name. And the bankruptcy court reasoned that the correct name must mean its legal name, which must mean the birth certificate name, and the court then avoided the bank's security interest. The bank appealed. U.S. District Court reversed the bankruptcy court and held that since a search of the UCC database under the name Benny A. Miller turned up five of the six secured creditors who also had lent money to Mr. Miller. And notice, only five of the six. It wasn't 100%, but it was close. And the bank's use of Benny A. Miller was permissible, and it furthered the UCC's policy of ensuring certainty for creditors and provided notice to third parties of the security interest. The real point here is that under alternative A, under House Bill 2600, none of this would have happened. There never would have been a trial in the bankruptcy court. There never would have been an appeal, because there would have been one name and one name only to appear on his financing statement, and that would have been his driver's license name. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. And we all know that our courts are overburdened. I suggest that there's no reason to add to that burden, and we should take opportunities to prep for them. I mean, it's a small thing, but we should favor certainty over uncertainty. We should favor easy over hard. We should try to minimize conflict and litigation, and we should try to make the UCC more uniform and put Oregon in the majority of other states. So if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to entertain those.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your testimony. We'll listen to the next testifier. We've got a lot of people left to testify.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Turgeson, chief lender at Citizens Bank in Corvallis, Oregon. We're a small community bank. We make a lot of farm loans and a lot of small business loans. So the UCC search and perfection of our collateral is very, very important to us. Last year when we reviewed this as a bank, we were all in favor of alternative A, using the driver's license, to the point even though that it, Oregon went with B, we still went with A as getting a copy of the driver's license, and that's what we put on our loan documents, and our UCC needs to match our loan documents, so we have the correct borrower and correct borrower's names. Corporations, we can get a article of corporations and get that information. LLCs and partnerships, we can get operating statements and get the legal names for that. Driver's license, we find, is the best way to get a legal name for an individual. This also helps our borrowers, especially in the farm industry. They're buying equipment from their neighbor, and to help them make sure that they've got a free and clear piece of property or equipment, we can have them get the driver's license name and search it for them. Otherwise, you're kind of guessing of what that equipment could be under, what name that could be under. So, like everything, I agree with everything that's been said here today, but it's very important for small community banks in particular that that we make some uniformity to this, and we kind of all agree on it. We've got dealers going one way, we've got credit unions doing another thing, and the banks doing another thing. If we can do it all in one, it would protect all of us.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Questions for this panel? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. I'm very familiar with UCC filings. While in no way doing the number of filings you do, I do about 100 a year. And I think there's a need for standardization. What I'm struggling with is I need the historical context of why the driver's license. When I was 18, I'm making this up. When I was 18, I was feeling kind of formal, and I went Gregory Vincent Smith. Then I lost my license, and 2 years later, I didn't want to be so snooty, so I went with Greg V. Smith. Then I decided 5 years later, you know, I think I'm going to go with Gregory V. Smith. Now, at the same time, at 18, I went and took out a loan for $100,000, secured it with the UCC, and that filing gets continued through the life of that 20-year loan. But my name on my license has changed now 3 times. Help me understand this.
The first time you applied for that loan, we would have looked at your driver's license at that time, and we would have done a search at that time. And as long as they matched up at that time, then it would have been perfected, and we would have had a prior security interest to any other subsequent lender. No matter how many times you changed your name on your driver's license. You bring up a good point, though, and Oregon law requires an individual to update their driver's license anytime their name changes. Unlike a birth certificate, you never change the name on your birth certificate, but on your driver's license, you get married, or if you get divorced and take a prior name, you're supposed to go in within 30 days and update your driver's license so that it's current with your current name.
So if I can just follow up, I really want to understand this. So the historical rationale that the industry came up with was because names change, but the name on the license is what you're supposing is always being used?
The name.
Then why wouldn't you just use the legal name that someone's been given and just say that's the standard? The name you've been given is the name you're using.
Well, I think the reason is that the driver's license is the most common and accepted means of identification.
And
it's a central searchable database.
Okay. Well, maybe someone. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. I got a lot of other folks left to testify here, so unless there's other questions.
Well, Mr. Chair, I did have a question.
Go ahead.
It's kind of along the same line in that we've had option B on the books for a period of time. Would you still have to go back and search for all name variations anyway? Even though you're on option, you're wanting option A?
Can I address that? Yes, you would for a while. And A is not perfect. And I think your point is well taken. But we've had an example where we have a family that's been a farming. They individually farm, so they don't farm as a family. But they all have the same name, Lindsay Grant Smith. I won't use their last name. We lent to the son, which is really Lindsey Grant Smith III. But our lenders wrote it up as Junior because they knew the dad didn't know the granddad. And I caught that. But they did a lien search. And there's a lien search for Robert Grant Smith, which is technically the grandfather, but the loan was to the father. If that ever went to court, that could have been thrown out. And the loan would have been to really the grandfather, not the father.
Thank you. I want to get to the Law Commission and listen to their testimony. I really appreciate you,
thank you.
Coming up and testifying today.
Thank you.
Up next, I have Lane Shetterly, Carl Gere, and Walt Goel. Well, I probably butchered those names, but...
Got one out of three.
That seems to be my batting average lately.
Mr. Chair, welcome
to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a real pleasure to be here. Lane Shetterly is my name, and I'm actually here. I'm wearing two hats today. Tim Martinez mentioned to you that the Article 9 Uniform Commercial Code comes to you from the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. It's a national organization of states, about 120 years old, that adopts laws in areas where uniformity among the states is important. Those laws, when they're adopted by the commission, don't become effective automatically. They go out to the states for states to adopt them, and then by doing them, we achieve a level of uniformity among the states. And the Uniform Commercial Code is probably the signature accomplishment of the Uniform Law Commission in its long history. I am a member from Oregon of the National Conference of Commissioners, and so I have some familiarity with this Article 9 effort, not as much as my fellow Commissioner Professor Bierre, who you'll hear from as well. And so I have that hat on. That is, as a member of the National Conference of Uniform Law Commissioners, I'm also chair of the Oregon Law Commission. And as Tim also said in his testimony, that's one of the functions that the Oregon Law Commission serves here in Oregon, to take these uniform acts and then put them through a work group process here in Oregon so that we have the opportunity to marshal the resources of attorneys and experts in the subject matter in state to tailor these uniform acts, because every act, although it's passed by the Uniform Law Commission, gets modified either for style or certain aspects of tailoring to the state in which it's being enacted. And we did that. The Oregon Law Commission took this these most recent Article 9 amendments in 2012 sponsored the bill that enacted the most recent amendments and explicitly opted for Option B. Part of that process in getting to Option B, I should say, is the work group effort. A typical work group of the Oregon Law Commission brings in 7 to 10 lawyers who are expert in the field in which the bill is to which the bill relates. They meet and spend months in a work group effort dealing with the issues. Then the bill goes to the full Oregon Law Commission for approval to be introduced before it comes to you. And so you know, just the scope of the Oregon Law Commission, just very briefly, it was created by statute in 1997, and its membership includes the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, the Attorney General, a representative appointed by the governor, the deans of the three law schools of the state, the Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals, a trial court judge, 4 members appointed by the Oregon State Bar, 2 members appointed by the Speaker of the House, 2 members appointed by the Senate President, and I think I've covered the membership there. So that is the group that passed this bill forward a year ago in its current form. When this bill was introduced this session, we took it back just to see if things had changed in the year's time. Were there considerations that we might have overlooked that would commend supporting this change from Option D to Option A? And a week and a half ago, this was back in front of the Law Commission. The Bankers Association was invited and did make a presentation. And I can tell you that the Law Commission voted with 1 dissenting vote to retain its support for Option B in the bill that was presented last session. And that 1 dissenting vote was really more a matter of, well, what do we care? After it's been introduced, it's not ours anymore, so maybe we just let it go. It was not a matter of supporting option A, but really more a question of the role of the commission at that point.
Supporting B.
So that's how we got here. And let me just tell you, as a member of the National Conference of Uniform Law Commissioners, I can say, in one respect, I'm agnostic between A and B because they're both uniform, and so it's good either way. I can tell you, though, that as a member of the Oregon Law Commission and a practitioner, I do have a personal preference that is very strongly for option B. You have received to your offices a handout from the Law Commission with reasons to support the bill, and I think it's important to support option B, and I think it's important to note it's not just a numbers game. It's not just a question of how many states are have adopted A, how many states have adopted B. There are real policy considerations to be made here. And in fact, I will tell you that in very few states do you have a law commission like you have here in Oregon to actually serve as that sieve to vet and prepare these bills for introduction to the legislature. Most often, uniform acts are introduced through industry or trade organizations that support them and are not run through this independent law commission process that we have. We look very carefully at all of the competing policy considerations. And the thing that you heard in that last panel, I agree with totally, is there is not a perfect answer. I think there is a better answer, and I think option B is clearly the better answer of the two. Just a couple of things that I want to touch on before I turn it over to Professor Bierre and Mr. Gowell. I'm not sure where it came from, but you did hear testimony that one of the reasons the Law Commission supported option B was to protect attorneys from malpractice. That is not in the report, and that is not in the reasons that you were provided for supporting option B. That was not a consideration of the Law Commission. It is a consideration of protecting unwary filers of financing statements, and very often those are farmers, small business people, and others who do use the process of searching and filing financing statements without the assistance often of legal counsel. And who are the ones most at risk probably for losing their secured status under financing statements if we go with option A because of the narrower target that we are creating. I will also say that the certainty that option A is represented to bring to the process of searching and perfecting a security interest is illusory. Representative Smith, you offered a great example there that certainly, for the time being and for years to come, prospective filers are still going to be having to be searching under all variants of a person's name in order to know that they indeed are in first position because there may be these previous filings of record for some time to come. And it's not just a matter of time until that won't be necessary because you have other security interests that are reflected in the same records at the Secretary of State's office, such as federal tax liens, that don't follow this rule. Federal tax lien is going to be filed under whatever name the taxpayer filed their tax return in. And so a careful secured party is always going to check the full option, the full range of names, in order to know that they're first. And thankfully, and this is another one of the reasons that we were comfortable in recommending B, we have sort of a natural language search process, and Tom Rosch from the Secretary of State's office is here. I don't think he signed up, but we have a process where the search will grab different variations of a name if you enter it for a search. And so it will help you find varieties of a common or of a single name. So we have a very friendly search process here in Oregon that we thought supported the policy reasons to go with option B. I would also say that you were cited a case in the previous testimony about a problem under the filing. You were not cited in an Oregon case. We've not been cited in an Oregon case that created an issue with how we have treated debtors' names that option B would continue and not change.
And Mr. Schiller, yes. If you could wrap up. I don't know if you remember, we don't have filibusters in the Oregon legislature.
But it's about those drones, Mr. Schiller. I was just getting to the end. I think it's just, again, to underscore that it's not a numbers game. It's really a question of policy. And as long as you have any number of states that are that have adopted option B, an out-of-state filer is going to have to check and see, is that an A or a B state? So it doesn't really throw any kind of wrinkle in the system for a state to be B, even if a majority of states have gone with option A. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Walter Gowell. That's Powell with a G from McMinnville. G-O-W-E-L-L. I'll just make five brief points because I know the committee's time is limited. One, I believe that this bill is an example of form over substance in that, and I say that because the use and the picking of only one name that, where there may be several names that clearly represent a person, which along with their address is part of the identifying information on a financing statement, any one of those can be sufficient to determine in a search and is used every day in a search to determine the relative priorities of other security interest holders. So to pick one out and say that Walter Raymond Gowell is the only name that I can be filed under instead of Walt Gowell, which many people know me as, or Walter Gowell, or Walter R., which is probably the one I signed my name with, that none of those would be sufficient and that all of those financing statements would be invalidated in the event that they were used by my local business because I filled out a credit application that way, and they didn't require me to give them my driver's license seems to elevate form over substance. Second, I agree with Mr. Chatterley's comment that this is a solution in search of a problem. If you look back, and I picked up the Oregon Digest today just because I was curious, there is no Oregon case since 1973 dealing with the issue of priorities in names under the Uniform Commercial Code in Oregon. And that case dealt with partnerships, not with individuals. Whatever system Oregon has been working smoothly for the last 45 years. And to indicate that a change to a more restrictive system is going to solve a problem is, I believe, not accurate. Third, one of the problems with the solution A or alternative A is that it relies on a database system that's not available to the public. In other words, the DMV system, if you're going to be able to check whether there is a valid license, whether it's still in force, whether the name has since changed since the copy of the license that you are being shown, and whether that information is accurate and verifiable, you have to have a database that is searchable by the parties who are seeking to use it. Right now, the DMV database is protected and is subject to privacy restrictions, which do not permit the search of that system to determine whether that name is still the same on the current license as it is on the one you're being shown. So it is, from a practical standpoint, Oregon has not advanced from a technology standpoint or from an information availability standpoint to the point where alternative A is a safe and secure method. It's risky. Finally, it's a trap for the unwary. Clearly, it may be true that 90% of financing statements are filed by lenders, and lenders are very good at technology and information systems and training of their officers. But the people that I represent, which is the small town credit managers, the local mill, the farmer who leases his land to his neighboring farmer and takes a security interest in the lease, those people are not sophisticated. They're not going to be up to speed, and their ability to use a common sense name that reflects what they're being told and which is searchable in the current database for UCC ought to be a sufficient name, and under current Oregon law is a sufficient name for their financing statement to be upheld. If we use alternative B, many of them will find themselves falling in priority behind the lender, and we all know what happens when you fall in priority behind the lender. From a practical standpoint, you're going to get nothing. So that is creating traps for the unsophisticated and unwary user of the system should be a concern. And finally, to me, uniformity at the price of equity is really never a great principle. So you have to be careful about how uniform you get and what the real world impact is on the small person who may be trying to use the system, may not have an Oregon attorney such as Lane or myself to help them through it, but still wants to be able to interface with their government in a way that doesn't lead them down a very dangerous path. So I thank you for the opportunity to make those comments.
Thank you. And if you could give us your testimony and try not to repeat, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Carl Bierre. I am a professor at the University of Oregon School of Law, and I specialize in commercial law, of which Article 9 is an important branch. It's all about secured lending, that is, protecting oneself with collateral. And I'll try to be as brief as possible, because most of the important points have been made. B, this is a very technical area, and we could easily sit here for hours without repeating ourselves about some of these difficult technicalities. I would like to stress the basic idea that all of Article 9, that is to say ORS Chapter 79, is a mechanism for creditors to protect themselves against other creditors. Any given borrower might have a number of lenders, bank number one, bank number two, crop suppliers, family members that are making loans, and so on. And the risk that any lender faces is that the borrower has a limited pot of assets and might not be able to repay everyone, and so a lender would like to protect itself, so much like a bank lending against real estate would like a mortgage. Now, there are two basic jobs for a lender to really protect itself correctly under Article 9. One is to file its own financing statement. That's analogous to recording a mortgage. Number two is to search the record and see whether other creditors have filed their own financing statements. That's how our lender knows whether he or she or it is first or not. So of those two jobs, filing your own and searching for others, what I want to stress is by far the most important is filing one's own. If you don't correctly file your own financing statement, you're not protected against any other creditor of the borrower. If the borrower goes bankrupt, the borrower has, God forbid, commits a tort and is sued for $1 million by the victim, if the borrower defaults on a mortgage to another lender, there's any one of untold possibilities of creditors that you might lose to if you don't file correctly. Now, compared to that, searching to see whether you were the first to file is advisable, but it is nowhere near as crucial. Let's say you search imperfectly, which is what the banking community is solely concerned about here. Very likely there's no one that filed before you anyway. There was nobody there for you to find. No competing creditor that is first in position as against you, so you're fine anyway. Moreover, even if there is somebody ahead of you, you're second to that person. You're still protected against all the other potential lenders to your borrower. So I would urge the committee not to be confused as to the importance of these two tasks, filing versus searching. Now, on filing, the basic idea is that alternative A makes searching easier at the cost of making filing more difficult. We heard one of the witnesses for the bankers say easy is better than hard, and nobody would disagree with that. But easy what and hard what? And unfortunately, as Mr. Shetterly said, there is no perfect statute. Easier filing means harder searching. And by the same token, unfortunately, easier searching means harder filing. Now, we can't make it easy for everybody to file, in other words, using various names, and make it easy for everyone to search, in other words, finding everything with one search. We have to make a choice about a little bit easier on one side versus a little harder on one side. There's no perfect answer, but as Mr. Shetterly said, there is a better answer. We can take this quantum of difficulty that we're faced with in coordinating all these lenders out against each other, and we can protect. We can set up a statute that takes into account the realities of how lenders behave. It may be that 90% of the loans are made by professional bankers, but that leaves 10% of the secured lending that we're talking about being made by unsophisticated or vulnerable or low volume or unlegally advised lenders. And to expect them to all file correctly, which is the important thing to do, according to a hyper-technical rule where only one variation that might not even be used by the creditor in his or her daily life and business and affairs. It happens to sit in their wallet, but it's not used. It's not signed on loan applications and so on. To expect 10% of these lenders without adequate legal advice to file such a technical rule, all in the service of making searching, which is a less important task, easier, is a serious policy mistake, in my humble opinion, and in the judgment of the 2012 legislature. Just one more point, which is uniformity and majority and so on. Yes, alternative B is in the minority nationwide. That's true. But the policy choices that each state makes is not a popularity contest. And it's irrelevant what the surrounding states, what Idaho and even Washington have done. If Washington is changing its mind, I think that's ill-advised, but it's irrelevant to what this legislature should choose as a policy matter. Alternatives A and B are both equally uniform. They're both offered to the states, as Mr. Martinez said, to permit the states to make a choice. There is no perfect choice, but there's a better choice, and we should make that choice on the merits, as we've discussed, not on the basis of popularity. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I'm going to open it up for questions here. I just wanted to announce that because of the length that this is taking, I will be carrying over House Bill 3169. Apologize to anybody who signed up for that. So with that, questions, Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, for a few questions. I'm confused because we're talking about uniform laws, and you start off, Mr. Shetterly, saying how the uniform system works and all this, and that A and B are both equally uniform, and then before we're done, we're hearing that there was 28 in favor of A, and then 29 in favor of A, and then 30 in favor of B, and there's 5 or 6, or maybe it's going to be 4, in favor of, I mean, those are all in favor of A, and there's going to be just a few in favor of B, but it's now irrelevant that the majority of the states, including all those around us, would go with A in a uniform, I mean, it's UCC, it's Uniform Commercial Code, and so if they were both the same, I mean, you know, they both would be equal, although we've got smarter attorneys looking at it here than other states do. I mean, you know, I appreciate that, and probably so. And so we know what's best, but in knowing what's best, we are essentially going counter to the whole movement toward uniformity. And the whole idea with uniformity was to go different states and be able, you know what's going on. And so I just find it interesting that it may be, and I understand that, it may be that I'm hearing a defense of what we've decided because we think it's going to be good, and we don't want to create traps, but my understanding is that if I'm a farmer and Bill comes over and he wants to borrow and I say, I'll put on your tractor and we'll do that, it would be hard for me to go and do the research to find out if he had already encumbered the collateral under William and all that, but if everybody used the driver's license, then at least I could go and just check on, they say, well, let me see your license and write that down, and I could check just based on the name. And so it just seems to me like if it's going to be a UCC, it's going to be uniform, maybe we ought to consider staying uniform, especially if all the states around us are going with what seems to be the trend, even if they're all diluted, because we know what's best. But it is uniform, and so uniformity might be something we'd want to go out. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
No comment.
If I may.
Yeah, please.
Representative Richardson makes an excellent point. This is a uniform commercial code.
Probably appreciate that.
Article 9 is a very lengthy statute, at least 100 pages. It provides for all sorts of intricate rules that have nothing to do with financing statements at all. And what we're focusing on here is one little passage on half a page of that statute. So we do have a uniform statute, and Oregon is 99.99% uniform on everything. All states are that degree of uniform. The Uniform Law Commission and the American Law Institute, which sponsor the Uniform Commercial Code, expressly gave states the option of choosing between either of two equally valid options on this one particular issue, and that's why we have disagreement. I'm all in favor of uniformity, and a number of years ago when we were doing the more extensive revision of Article 9 that Mr. Martinez referred to, I was a strong voice in favor of keeping Oregon's statutes uniform. I still am. I just want to stress that A and B are uniform. Oh, and in terms of confusion among lenders and so on, one of the many other points that Article 9 makes clear is that each borrower is governed by one and only one set of laws. Every lender, if it knows the first thing about lending, knows to focus on the statutes of the state where the borrower lives, so that what lenders are doing in surrounding states is irrelevant unless they are lending to Oregon borrowers. And in that very basic situation, they ought to be aware of Oregon law.
Thank you. I appreciate the testimony and a riveting issue on A and B. And I'm going to be reading about this late at night, I'm sure. So I really appreciate the testimony and you making the effort to come and give the Law Commission's point of view on House Bill 2600. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2600.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And open a public hearing on 2295 and Representative Reed. And Bob, if you could give us a quick summary of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2295 appropriates money from the General Fund to the Oregon Progress Board, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. Yep.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for your patience as well. It took a little bit longer to talk about uniform commercial codes than I anticipated. So with that, if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I appreciate the education this afternoon. I can't say that I am as well informed on it as the committee, but I appreciate the introduction. I will be very quick. I know the hour is late, and appreciate hearing this this bill. I just want to tell you a very quick story about why we're here, and then the COO will hopefully explain a little more of the context. When I was in graduate school, I had an excellent managerial accounting professor who has since become the dean of the business school, and he said, if I run into you at a cocktail party some years from now, you have to remember just two things to consider my class a success. He said, incremental analysis, and you get what you measure. It's in that second, the spirit of that second statement that we bring this bill to you. Many of you, I suspect, are more familiar with the history of the Progress Board in Oregon than I am. But I was really struck when I got to the legislature about the value of understanding the aims of policy that we're considering. And a good example that many of you have experienced directly is the question of 40-40-20. If we say that around here, most people have some sense that that's the goal to which the legislature has committed with respect to education. And if nothing else, like it or not, I think that's been really effective as a test. As we consider various policy proposals, a lot of the conversations I've been a part of or listened to are sort of punctuated by that 40-40-20 concept. Does this proposal move us toward our goal, or does it move it away? And Mr. Jordan has been doing some good work in helping us try to return to that heritage of having performance measures that span the diversity of the state, all the different situations to which our policy proposals are directed. And what we'd like to do is try to reintegrate some of the history of the Progress Board and some new forms that are consistent with that, with our policy and budget-making process. So with that, I will be happy to answer any questions and commend Mr. Jordan's comments to you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Jordan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the state, and I'm also the Department of Administrative Services Director. Representative Reed asked me to come today to talk a bit just about to the bill and the intent here, which I am in support of. House Bill 2295 is an attempt to reinvigorate outcome-based measurement for the state. But more than that, there have been a number of
of efforts going on in Oregon regarding outcome-based measurement and indicators to see how we're doing as a state, both as an urban landscape in one case and across rural Oregon in another case. We, as you know, have worked hard to put together a long-range plan from the executive's perspective in Oregon, have attempted to build our budget to try and direct our appropriations towards those outcomes, and in doing so, we are attempting to build a regime to measure how we do over time. Most of you know that was one of the big outcomes intended for the Progress Board in its day. The Progress Board has not been funded for some time now, since the early 2000s. However, still is in existence and resides, at least currently, within the Department of Administrative Services. The attempt here is to reinvigorate the notion of societal outcome measurement to try and help our ability to make resource allocation decisions, both from the executive and the legislative perspective, and link those decisions to the policy outcomes that we're trying to achieve. What I'm intent on doing, from my perspective as a manager in state government, is not to reinvent the wheel. What I would like to do is to link our efforts through this bill that attempts to reinvigorate the Progress Board, is to link our efforts to efforts that are going on both at Portland State University and at Oregon State University. Both you've heard about the Explorer Project at Oregon State and the Portland Pulse Project at PSU. Those are both robust outcome measurement and indicator projects. The last thing, I guess, that I want you to know from my perspective is that the last thing I want to do is reinvent the wheel. What I really want to do is try and link any efforts we are making at the state level to efforts that are already fairly robust in these areas, and see if through collaboration we can end up with a regime of outcome indicators that, quite frankly, lots of folks in Oregon can use, not just governmental entities. The foundation community, I know, is very much in search of a set of metrics that we can all kind of utilize to leverage investment. And so that's what I'm here to do today, is support the effort in 2295 and commit to you that for me, it's really about how do we leverage other work that's going on in the state and partner to try and get the best outcome we can.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I've neglected to mention two things, if I might. One is that we have some amendments that are not quite to our liking yet, but don't get too excited about the relative brevity of the bill as it exists in front of you. And that there, I believe there are some people here from Portland State and from Oregon State who might comment on the Explorer Program and the Portland Pulse, to the extent your schedule allows.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony, and I guess we'll be watching for some amendments. And I'll go ahead and invite up the representatives from OSU and PSU, and if you have some comments you'd like to put on the record, that's Beth Imshaw, Meg Merrick, Jason Georgievich, I think, and Lena Etuk. And as much as you can keep your comments brief, since we have a lot of amendments coming on this bill, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Chair Holvey, representatives, thank you for giving us the opportunity today to chat with you. We were invited here to highlight our proposal relating to the existing infrastructure of two projects, one project at Portland State, which is...
And if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Jason Georgievich, Acting Director of the Population Research Center and Institute of Portland Metropolitan Studies. Two projects that both universities are working on that we have developed some early collaboration on, one being the Greater Portland Pulse, which is an indicators-based project for the three-county Portland metropolitan region, and the Rural Communities Explore, which is a project of Oregon State. So if I could just direct you to the testimony that we provided, the written testimony, which gives you an overview of both projects as well as the organizations that would be involved in this collaborative partnership. In the first part of the testimony, we propose formalizing a collaborative partnership between existing institutes at both universities, the Institute of Portland Metropolitan Studies, the Population Research Center, Open Campus, the Rural Studies Program, and Extension from Oregon State. So basically merging those, the faculty expertise, the data infrastructure projects that are already in place, and the research centers at both universities to be able to provide these indicator data for the state and its communities. If you look on in Addendum A, in the back of the written testimony, it lists the research centers that would be part of this partnership, the objectives of each of those research centers, as well as a little bit of background regarding the Rural Communities Explorer and the Greater Portland Pulse. So as Michael Jordan and Representative Reed alluded to, an indicators-based project is an important project for measuring where we are today, where we're headed in the future, and how exactly we get there around a number of indicators relating to education, health, the economy, economic development specific to the state and its communities. We have proposed in this written testimony a partnership, a proposal for the partnership in terms of the two universities around developing a community needs assessment for communities, looking at strategic planning to develop collaboration between the two universities, as well as outreach and training to not just simply provide the indicators, but to help in a way that allows communities to make sense of the data at the local scale. The last part of the memo also details the return on investment that this bill would provide in terms of funding the universities. 1 through 5, I'll just go through these briefly. Leveraging the capacity of the existing assets, both at PSU and OSU.
I would add, we have that in written form.
Okay.
You could just make a summary so we can get the other folks on
sure.
the record. I appreciate it.
Sure. In total, we feel that through these as these 5 points highlight, there's a great return on the investment with respect to the fact that we're leveraging existing university-based assets to provide the states in these communities indicators around these outcomes.
Thank you, I appreciate it. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, whoever wants to speak next, or are you all done?
She spoke. You asked a question.
Okay.
I would just add.
You're speaking for everyone.
Exactly.
I wasn't aware of that.
Questions. We have people from both PSU and OSU
okay.
that are.
One question: how does this relate to the bill?
That's a good question.
Well, we've been asked basically to develop the proposal that would the funding. The bill would actually provide funding to recreate the funding for the Progress Board. So rather than having the Progress Board provide the indicators, the funding would come to the universities to provide the indicators that the Progress Board identifies.
Thank you. I appreciate that piece. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony, and didn't mean to rush you. I thought all four of you were going to testify, so I'm glad that you had a lot of support and spoke for everyone. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Richardson.
The comment to the committee on this, I don't know how this all plays out as far as what the real motives are, whether they really are, just to get more funding for a new way to do this, but the idea of focusing on getting outcomes, which is what the Progress Board was intending to do before it got defunded, and I was here when that happened, it was like, well, we don't need to do that because we know where we're going. But what they're really doing is they're working like a conscience for the legislature, because they would point out that the KPM, the key performance measures, may not be working like they're supposed to. And what was happening, and what I fear happens again, is that you come and you just budget to fund, where the performance measures are supposed to go back to the executive and their committee for strategic planning, and then you fund the programs. And the purpose of the programs are to accomplish the goals of the strategic plan. Mm-hmm. What outcomes do you want? What programs will help us get those outcomes? And then you measure the success by the KPMs and other things to see whether or not the programs that you're funding are bringing about the outcomes that you want. And if not, then that should change the programs, where in reality it's very difficult to change any program because of the constituencies and the politics. But anyway, what is being attempted is certainly we need data and information to do that if that's really where the funding goes.
I agree. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2295. And committee, going to open a work session on House Bill 2662. Bob, can you let the committee briefly know what this is about? And we have, I believe, two amendments we're looking at.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2662 prohibits owner neglect of vacant foreclosed residential real property, authorizes local government to impose civil penalty using a specified process, and declares an emergency and is effective on passage. The committee has proposed -1 amendments that clarify the owner shall provide means of contact during period of vacancy of foreclosed property. There's also a proposed -2 amendment, which authorizes local government to remedy neglect directly or through contract and attach lien for the sum of their unreimbursed costs. And I should note on this measure, there is minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact on the bill, both with the -1 and -2 amendments.
Thank you. And Representative Richardson, I don't know if you'd care to comment on the amendments. I know you worked with Representative Frederick, and he thought maybe you might comment on those amendments if you care to.
Certainly. After Representative Fredericks gave his testimony, we talked about what his real outcome was. What did he want to do? And the goal was to stop blighted neighborhoods. You know, you got abandoned properties which become a real blight on the neighborhood. And so some of the suggestions that were proposed originally really beat around the bush, but they didn't do that. The -2 amendment, instead of saying, we'll provide a way that you can sue somebody that doesn't care anyway or may have no money, it allows the local municipality to make contact, and then if nothing's done, then they can take action and have the yard cleaned up, or have the broken windows fixed or boarded up or whatever, and then the actual cost for doing that is added as a lien on the property that is equal only with like tax liens, and so it's ahead of the first mortgage. And that way, whoever is ultimately going to be getting this property back will have a little motivation maybe to take care of the property, because they're going to have to pay for the upkeep, whether they provide it or the city does. But what the outcome is that the neighbors will have a property that, instead of being derelict and completely ignored, could be maintained, and the cost of that, the actual cost to do that maintenance, could become a lien on the property, which gets paid when this property is ultimately sold. Anyway, that is the goal.
Thank you.
Question.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. If I can ask the good vice chair a question.
Certainly.
Vice Chair, can you share with us why the lien created needs to be a senior lien rather than a junior lien?
The reason that we made it a senior lien was because the lien holder is ultimately going to be responsible for the property. If I've got a mortgage on a property, I want to take care of it. If the city were to take the cost of that, or assume the cost, and then their lien is junior, then I get my money either way. And so I have no motivation to help make sure that this property is cared for. And so by having the city say, you know, you take care of it, mortgage holder, or if you don't, then we're going to, and we're going to add this, and you'll end up paying for it at the foreclosure sale, it to me makes an incentive for the creditor to take care of the property, because the city doesn't want to do that.
Follow up. Thank you. Can you define for us then what taking care of means?
Well, each
what,
city...
What level of care, what level of maintenance will be done and now filed ahead of the primary mortgage holder?
The municipalities each will have ordinances as to neglect and whatever, there's another term for property, but essentially it's...
Blight and nuisance.
Blight, nuisance, yeah, nuisance or neglect. And so the goal would be to rectify something that is a blight, nuisance or neglect, and the city really has there's no incentive for them to spend a whole lot of money that is unnecessary, because that's money out of their current general fund. And so I think that the natural incentive would be for them to pay whatever is a minimum.
Last follow-up. And I hear you loud and clear. I'm not sure that's accurate, though, because they're now a senior
lien holders, which means they're going to get paid. And so a city could go in and say, you know, we not only want the lawn mowed, but we want it watered, and we want the shutters fixed, mm-hmm. and we want the house painted, and we want the roof redone. And we're going to do all these improvements, and now we're going to become the senior lien holder.
All of those things, I assume, would increase the value at the sale. So that actually would be a benefit for the mortgage or the creditor as well, because now when the property is going to be sold, it would present better if that were to happen. Although having been on city council, I know, I mean, maybe that would happen somewhere, but they're very tight on their money, and it would normally be what is the least that we're going to have to expend because we need that money elsewhere. But certainly it could happen, but there would be not necessarily just a negative consequence from that.
And certainly, I think also the argument that, you know, if the lien for the city was junior, they have the, I guess, real potential that they would never get paid for rectifying the blight.
I was just hoping that we'd be able to define what the corrective action could entail, because mm-hmm. as it's written right now, it's wide open, and a municipality could take broad authority and that could create a real burden.
I would just like to ask, based on that, because moving the lien higher helps deal with some of the concerns I had about it. But I have the concern I still have though is this definition in that, and whether does a city have to take any action based on this, or it's still it's left to them to decide
under
to
them.
Take the action. Thank you.
So it is the it's option of the decide, city. Right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a little bit of. I mean, I perfectly endorse the view in my or the intent, but words like reasonable costs are hard for me to define. I don't know exactly what that means, and that could be defined in a lot of ways. And I think Representative Smith, I think, was on target too, saying, you know, what is reasonable? What is due diligence? You know, is it simply making sure the lawn is mowed? If you have broken windows, do we simply board them up or do we replace them? And that could vary considerably from neighborhood to neighborhood or municipality to municipality, kind of depending on the theme of the community and so forth, too. It could be different. Furthermore, I think there's a great potential to have a lot of the municipality who's in charge to be investing a lot taxpayer resources into this upkeep, if you will, without the assurance that they're going to get their money back at any point certain as well. So some municipalities, cash-strapped municipalities, could be out some significant costs that they don't have any date certain about being able to recoup those costs as well, depending on when a transaction does or does not occur. So I endorse the idea, the thought behind it. I'm not sure this is the proper way to get there.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Representative Thatcher.
Well, yeah, I have a question about whether this would only still apply to foreclosed properties, because there are certainly other blighted looking properties that aren't mm-hmm. necessarily in foreclosure. So.
Granted, and I certainly think that as the bill was presented, the real problem many neighborhoods, especially in the Portland area, were suffering were from foreclosed properties where people couldn't find anybody to take responsibility for fixing the blight or the neglect, and certainly that's not a great scenario either. And so, like many pieces of legislation, there is no perfect outcome. I think we're faced with moving forward or not moving forward. So, Representative Richardson.
I have no dog in this fight, by the way. It's not my neighborhood, and it's now become my bill. I'm trying to help Representative Fredericks in a Portland issue that is a real problem for them. And if we got together, these great ideas, maybe we could actually make this bill better.
Right.
I'd be happy to testify in his behalf over, I represent him over in the Senate, right, with requests that we have some amendments over there if we want to go forward. But anyway.
Well, in light of the discussion, maybe we will we'll take a pause in this particular agenda and have another discussion of whether there is some room to improve this bill with some more precise definition. Though I think that no action on this issue leaves a greater problem than acting. But with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2662. and open a work session on House Bill 2536. And Bob, give us a brief introduction about House Bill 2536.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2536 requires a court or administrative authority to make additional specific findings before approving an agreement for transfer of structured settlement rights. It extends the period in which a transfer agreement may be canceled by settlement payee, and we have individuals here to speak to both Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments to the bill. And I'll note for the committee, no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on this measure with the amendments, Mr. Chair.
So, committee, I wanted to give an opportunity to both sides of this issue to present the amendments that they worked on. And this bill's been under discussion for since 2009, I believe, the first time I met Mr. Nesbitt and Mr. Milligan as well. So with that, I will ask the Dash 2 amendment proponent to come up and talk to us a little bit about the Dash 2, why the Dash 2 and not the Dash 3. And if you can kind of sum this up in about 3 minutes, you know, I think you can hit the main points as you did with me, and then we'll get the other side up to talk about the other side of this issue. So,
my name is Earl Nesbitt of the National Association. I'm executive director of the National Association of Settlement Purchasers. This is a complex bill. It is a complex arena. So summing it up in 3 minutes is going to be tough, but I'll do my best. A couple of things to recall. Right now, we have a transfer statute on the books in Oregon that works for the 159 transactions that were done last year by our members, maybe a total of 200. The bill, as proposed, and with the Dash 3 amendments, while well-intentioned, frankly, makes the process more intrusive, more expensive, and more time-consuming for our customers, the payees, ironically the consumers, for whom the bill is intended to protect. There are a lot of issues with the bill. We met with Chairman Hovey and the proponents of the bill. We went through our concerns. We gave them detailed proposal amendments, which we've submitted to the committee, and they came back with amendments that adopted two of ours. So we did okay, 2 out of 20. But right now, the bill as it's presented, I'm just going to hit 3 main issues. There are a lot of issues with the bill, and it really deserves more attention and more discussion. But for instance, one of the concerns that we raised, and I think that our proponents acknowledged was a concern, was the amount of personal, financial, confidential information that the bill requires to be included in the petition about children and ages and resources and income and payees and spouses. We felt like that information should be confidential and submitted to the court. The court certainly needed to know that. Currently, how the court gets that information is simply asking questions. So what we proposed was you file a petition that has minimal information about that this is a transaction, and it's filed with the court. Then before the hearing, 10 days before the hearing, another document, a separate document, is submitted that contains all of this personal, confidential information. And we felt like that got the information before the court and allowed them to prepare for the hearing, and then they have the opportunity to ask those questions. The Dash 3 amendments requires that information to be included in the petition. And the way that it was addressed with the Dash 3 amendments, that's not the we're supporting the Dash 2 amendments, is that the court may seal that information. Not shall seal it, but they may seal it. But the petition must be attached to the notice and provided to the structured settlement obligor, the annuity issuer, all interested parties, all beneficiaries. So that information is going to be provided to a lot more people than the court. In our proposal, the only thing that's going to be public record is the petition identifying that there's a transaction going to go forward, and then the transfer agreement and the disclosure statement that's provided is going to be sent to those interested parties, and then the confidential information is going to be filed with the court. So it's much more respectful of the privacy of the payee, and we believe it addresses this situation much better. And I will tell you that our customers, who are the payees, who are the people most affected, would sit here and tell you, I don't want to have all that. The second main point is currently under the transfer, under the current transfer statute, we must provide to our customers a disclosure statement that sets forth the terms of the transaction and certain admonishments about independent professional advice 3 days before they sign a transfer agreement. We propose that we lengthen that to 10 days, and we add additional admonishments into that disclosure. It should be provided before they sign any contract, and then they have 10 days after signing the contract to rescind it. So they have plenty of time to consider their options after they have something in writing telling them exactly what they're going to be selling and what they're being given. The Dash 3 amendments that are before you that we oppose would require two disclosures and then another 10-day rescission period and then a 20-day notice period. The first disclosure does not include anything about the terms of the transaction, and it must be provided 30 days before they sign a transfer agreement. Then we must provide another disclosure 10 days before the transfer agreement that has the terms of the transaction. Then we have to provide notice of the hearing 20 days in advance, and there's also a 10-day rescission period. The problem with that is, quite literally, the way to kill this business in Oregon is to impose a 30-day admonishment every time the terms of the transaction changes, because this is a negotiation that we do with people, and so each time the terms of the transaction complies, arguably, you have to provide the 30-day admonishment. In any event, the 30-day admonishment, all it says is you have the right to get independent professional advice, you should get professional advice, you should consider other options, and the court can require you to get professional advice at the end of this transaction period, 60 or 90 days down the road, and the court can require you to get additional offers.
We believe, and if you could wrap up, because I need to give fair time to the other testifiers.
All right, I've got one more thing on this, and then one more quick thing. We believe. Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the time, and I came a long way, but this is very, very important and for our customers. In any event, what you are basically left with is you're telling these people, we believe you tell them you got to get an attorney, you should get an attorney, you should consider other offers, but what we don't believe is you need to do that at the beginning of the process, not at the end of the process after they've waited 120 days to stand in front of the judge and tell their story. Finally, we agree with Chairman Hovey that certain factors should be set forth in the bill to provide some court, some guidance. Where we differ is what those factors should be. We agree that it should be whether they're employed, whether they're employable, what their income is, what the reasons for the transfer is, all that we have agreement. What the chairman's bill does is also require us to disclose all prior transactions, whether it was done 20 years ago or 2 months ago, and all prior attempted transactions. We believe that more reasonable is to disclose prior transfers within the last 4 years and then prior attempted transfers within the last year. And I could go into why that is, but I'm afraid I'm going to get cut off, so I'm not going to do that. The final point is in the factors proposed by the chair's amendments, the Dash 3 amendments, after you've gone through all these 30-day disclosures, 10-day disclosures, 20-day notice, and scheduled a hearing, filed all this stuff, provided it to all these interested parties, at the end of the day, there is language in this bill that says the court can look at them and say, I'm going to make you go get IP, independent professional advice, even though you've been admonished to do it 90 days ago and you chose not to. You've got to pay for it. And even though you were admonished 90 days ago to consider other offers to raise this money and consider other offers from other people, I'm going to force you to do it.
And thank you. I appreciate that, because you've already stated that once, and I we're running out of time, and it wouldn't be fair not to allow
thank
somebody
you, Mr.
else.
Chairman.
Thank you. And if you could sit there might be questions on after we get done with the next panel.
Certainly. You sit here or sit back there?
You can sit back there if you wish. That'd be fine. Go ahead. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Representative Holby, my name is Jack Nelligan. I'm the president of Settlement Professionals. I am a 33-year veteran of the financial services industry in this state. 27 of that spent working with injury victims, not only in this state, but around the country. I believe that the right to factor payments is a useful right. The problem that I think this bill solves, and I don't want to address all of the previous speaker's points directly. I just want to make a general comment. The reason that I think that this legislation is needed is that we deal with injury victims and their families. Some of these people have severe catastrophic injuries. The ones that are most susceptible to needing this kind of oversight are certain types of injuries where, for instance, they've got a head injury that's considered a traumatic brain injury, but it's not traumatic enough that they have a conservator to watch their financial affairs. And those particular people seem to be the ones that are most apt to want to factor payments. And one of the issues that we've run into is the judges and the judicial system not asking enough questions of these people to determine their situation. Do they have children? Do they have a spouse, a spousal order in a divorce situation, child support? Were the payments that they're trying to factor or sell originally intended to take care of their lifetime medical needs? And how is that going to be replaced? So I don't want to spend a lot of time refuting and point for point Mr. Nesbitt's arguments. I just wanted to say that I'm here today to support this because for some of our clientele, our mutual clientele, we need the judiciary to ask more questions.
Hello, Mr. Chair. My name is Nolan Robinson. I'm a certified structured settlement consultant in Beaverton, Oregon, with 11 years of experience. Mr. Milligan caught most of the main points, and I think ultimately that what we hope to achieve through this is just a better job of ensuring that every transaction that occurs in this state is in the best interest of the current payee. And of the bills that we've seen go through, this is by far the stronger option to do that. You know, the fact is that the judges don't always have the information they need to make an informed decision on this. So every opportunity we can give them, and again, it's not always the same judge hearing these in every jurisdiction. You know, it changes, and so we need to make sure that someone who's coming in new is going to have all that information as well as those that are there. So we just want to make sure that we're protecting the people who we work so hard to try to protect at the time of their settlements.
Thank you. And I know that neither one of you were the attorney that also worked when our work group to us on these issues. And you're speaking to the dash threes, and I think Mr. Nesbitt was speaking to the dash twos, and there lies still some disagreement, obviously, around which is the best pathway on that. But I do appreciate your participation, because I know you spent a lot of hours, and as well as Mr. Nesbitt as well on this. So are there questions from the committee on
a clarification for Mr. Nesbitt? He said this may be 120 days. As I read the dash threes, it says that there must be a 30-day waiting period before the transfer is signed. Well, you negotiate. You don't enter a contract and then negotiate. You go back and forth. You negotiate. And then when you reach an agreement, that's when you would sign the document. And that's when it seems to me that your 30-day period would begin. So I finally understood you to say that every time there's an offer made that there has to be a 30-day waiting period. I certainly didn't read that in this.
Bob, the dash three bill says that 30 days before they sign the transfer agreement, you have to send out this initial admonishment.
Right.
And then you have to send out another admonishment 10 days before the transfer agreement is signed. So you're sending out two admonishments before they ever sign anything. Then if you get to the hearing and the court says, hey, you have to go get two more offers, then those people have to send out new 30-day admonishments and new 20-day admonishments. And now you're looking at 6 months.
Okay, I'm with you on that. I would say, though, that judges are not going to just say, I got an idea. Why don't we delay this and have them go out and get different offers unless the judge would feel like something has gone wrong or that there needs to be something considered. So I'm just mentioning for clarification, both 2 and 3 will strengthen the law. 3 just requires more information to be given to the judge, and it would not necessarily require a 120-day delay.
Thank you.
And both do require the same information to be given to the judge. Just some of it was required to be given in the petition. In our proposed amendments, it's required to be given in a confidential.
Got it.
Yes. Mr. Chair. There is one other difference from the dash 2 that we worked on last month versus dash 3 is dash 2 does omit certain information, for instance, that the information is intended for, that the original settlement proceeds were intended for future medical care, for instance, something that we find is very significant. So there are a few things that are missing from those in terms of the information that's disclosed.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And we're not going to move this bill today, and so we're going to be able to have some more questions and give us some time to absorb the dash 2s and the dash 3s with that. So appreciate that. Appreciate you making the effort and the trip again, and apologize for the short time. I know in Texas you like to dance around a little bit more and spend a little more time on the issues. And
they only meet once every 2 years.
It used to be like that.
But anyway,
too much.
Anyway, thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2536. And Bob, I think we have time for House Bill 2856. Let's try House Bill 2856.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2856 provides an exemption from the mortgage loan originator licensing requirements for an individual who offers or negotiates terms for up to 3 residential mortgages per year, unless federal law specifically preempts that exemption.
Thank you. I believe I did. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2856. And if we get Sean Jillian's come up real quick. And I know we worked on this, Mr. Jillians. I just want to check in just real quickly before we get booted out of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Room. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I see the time. We love the dash twos. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for working with us.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the dash 2 amendments clarify language regarding the potential federal preemption, limit the seller to a portfolio of no more than 8 residential mortgages at one time. The measure has no fiscal and no revenue impact with the dash 2 amendments.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and it allows up to 3 a year, no more than 8, if I'm correct, Mr. Jillians.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And so, committee, this does give that seller-financed properties at least some room to not be required to be licensed loan originators, which is, if you recall, was the purpose of this bill. There was some angst over people that sell their own property and carry paper, essentially sell their own financing. Being required to be loan originators are under our current law. We passed a loan originator bill earlier in this session. This was an issue that was sort of circling out there that we didn't get addressed, and I wanted to make sure we addressed it for some of those seller-owned properties. So with that, Representative Lively, can we have a motion on that?
Sure. Chair, I move we adopt dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2856, dated 3-2013.
Representative Lively moves the adoption of the dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2856, dated 3-2013. Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendment? Discussion? No objection? Seeing no objection, they are adopted. Representative Lively.
Chair, I move House Bill 2856 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2856 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Samantha, can we have a vote?
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Penny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2856, having received the votes, is passed. We'll put this one on the consent calendar and close the work session on House Bill 2856. We will carry over House Bill 3159, House Bill 2824, House Bill 2536, House Bill 2662, and House Bill 2207. With that, I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection, Government Efficiency.